It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new research shows there are a lot more small streams and creeks flowing into Lake Superior than scientists previously thought. We'll talk to a researcher about the impact these small tributaries are having on the biggest of the Great Lakes. First, if you find yourself heading back to work after a day or two off and feeling a little underwhelmed with how you just spent your time, you may need to rethink how you prepare for your weekend. Whether you work a regular Monday to Friday gig or have a different kind of schedule, we all want to spend our time off the right way, maybe getting stuff done, doing stuff we enjoy and that has meaning to us. But getting the weekend right can take a little more planning ahead than we realize. Laura Vanderkam is the author of several time management and productivity books, including What the Most Successful People Do on the Weekends and Off the Clock, Feel Less Busy While Getting More Done. Her work has appeared in publications including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, and Fortune. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we'll talk in terms of like a two-day weekend. I know people have different schedules, but by the time we get to that weekend, a lot of times a lot of people might feel like, hey, no plans. I want to do nothing this weekend. What's wrong with that? Taking that approach?
Well, the first problem is that it's impossible to do nothing. You'll do something, but it might not be nearly as rejuvenating as if you'd put a tiny bit of thought into it. And that's really kind of the point of our days off, right, is to rejuvenate ourselves, to add to our energy levels so we can do all the amazing things that we're doing in life. And so, you know, it's hard to get our heads around this idea, but I really do think that leisure time is too precious to be completely leisurely about it. We need to put a little thought into it.
Right. The risk is, and I've been here, other people have, then we sit and, oh, let's see what's on TV. I'll watch half this football game I didn't really care about. And what's on my phone? I'll look at that for a while. We just kind of, we could squander it if we don't do a little planning, right?
Exactly. And the sad part of that is then people feel like, oh, I have no free time. And yet we did. We had free time. It's just we used it for things that didn't actually make us feel better and didn't make us feel like we were enjoying life. So, you know, it behooves us to ask the question, well, what do I like to do? What adds to my energy levels? What would be enjoyable for myself and the people I care about? And then how can I find some time on the weekend or make some time, I guess is a better phrase, to make those things happen?
Start us off on, say, Friday night. How do we organize our weekend? Maybe start doing stuff then, but also come up with a plan to harness the power of that weekend.
Well, I'd actually suggest starting earlier. You know, Friday night is great if maybe you don't have a whole lot of other people who are involved in your weekend plans. But if there are, for instance, if you've got kids who have to do stuff, your spouse wants to do stuff, you're trying to meet up with friends, maybe you need reservations somewhere, if you need a babysitter, like you probably got to think about it a little bit before Friday night. So maybe, you know, Wednesday in the middle of the week or something, take just 15 minutes to think about your weekend. Say, well, what three things would I like to do that would add to my energy levels? Also, then look at the weekend itself and see, well, what's already on the schedule for it? Because, again, if there's lots of people involved, there's probably something there already, you know, birthday parties, kids' sporting events, something your spouse signed you up for, whatever it is. You know, and then figure out, well, how can you make these things you want to do fit in around these other things? And then you can, you know, send your text to a babysitter or make a reservation at a restaurant or whatever you need to do. But if you think about this ahead of time, it vastly increases the chances that it actually happens.
Now, I have kind of maybe the opposite worry that thwarts me. I don't want to overplan. I want to overcommit myself on the weekend, and that can end up resulting in me severely undercommitting myself on the weekend and having that fritter away time. How do I get myself in the right mindset?
You're right that it's really a balance. But I think there's a huge space between planning every minute and planning nothing. Like, this is really a false choice. You can definitely find something in the middle that's a happy balance. So, you know, maybe it's that you want to do three things on the weekend. There's a lot of hours. I calculated this once. There's like 60 hours between 6 p.m. Friday and 6 a.m. Monday. You're probably awake for about 36 of those. So, you know, if you plan three things over the course of 36 hours, that leaves quite a bit of downtime, which you can fill with, you know, staring at the clouds, or more likely for most of us, watching TV, puttering around the house, or checking social media. But, you know, planning three meaningful things means that you'll get to the end of the weekend and say, hey, I actually did something. Like, somebody asked you, what did you do this weekend? You have an answer that can create an actual, you know, meaningful, enjoyable conversation, as opposed to, you know, I watched a bunch of TV that I really can't remember.
We're talking about making the most of our time off. Laura Vanderkam is with us, author of books including Off the Clock, Feel Less Busy While Getting More Done. Laura, it can be tempting for a lot of people, depending on the job, to do some work over the weekend. How can we set up that border, make sure we don't let work take over our time off?
Well, I'd quibble a little bit with this. I don't think there's anything horrible about doing a little bit of work on the weekend. And for some people who have certain kind of lives, doing a little bit of the work on the weekend can actually make the rest of life feel more doable. Somebody has a job where they need to leave a little bit early every day to make a daycare pickup. Sometimes doing a little bit of work on the weekend allows them to feel like they can keep moving forward, as opposed to feeling like, well, I'm always the person who's racing out and I can't get the hours in that I need to. But if you are going to do work on the weekend, just as with planning your leisure time, you want to be mindful about it. You don't want to be checking your phone every 10 minutes because, you know, nothing's coming in every 10 minutes that you need to see, and it'll just make you feel like you have no downtime at all. So think ahead of time, well, if I'm going to do work this weekend, what do I truly need to accomplish by Monday? Not, you know, I'm going to get through a 2,000 email backlog, because you won't. But practically, what am I going to get through? And then what would be a good sort of unobtrusive time for me to do it? Maybe if you've got teenage kids, doing it like Saturday morning from 7 to 9:30 would be great, because as far as they know, you don't even exist then. Or maybe it's that you will do a little bit on Sunday night after sort of you're already in work week mode, and maybe 8 to 10 on Sunday night, that could be a reasonable time for it. But making sure that you don't feel like you're always doing it, set a time for it.
Let's focus in on how we start our days. You did a brief video talking about the snooze button. You're not a fan. Tell us why.
Well, basically, because snooze sleep is really the worst of all worlds. You're not getting up and starting your day, but you're not actually getting the deep restorative sleep that makes you feel more rested either. So you're sleeping in these little like 9-minute increments that are doing very little for you other than delaying the start of the day and making you feel, you know, more grumpy that you keep having to hit the snooze button. So set your alarm for the time that you actually intend to get out of bed. And then enjoy every last minute of sleep right up until that point. It's all about being honest with ourselves. I mean, maybe you're telling yourself, yes, I'm going to get up and, you know, have this beautiful 90-minute morning routine involving exercise and meditation and journaling and writing the great American novel. But if it's not really going to happen, like, go ahead and just enjoy your sleep. Then you'll have the energy to do those things later in the day.
Now, we're doing a lot of different stuff over the weekend. And I think with time off, a lot of people might think, oh, I need to be productive. I need to get stuff done. How can we figure out the right amount of time? And now I'm not talking work here, just in our lives, house, writing the book, whatever. How can we set aside the right amount of productivity time that we actually get stuff done, but, you know, don't crowd out the chill time?
Yeah, I think like with paid work, you want to set a time for it. Because that way, you know, you're not having this conversation with yourself the whole weekend of like, oh, I should be working on X. I should be studying for that class I want to take, or writing that book, or, you know, doing that project around the house that I keep saying I'm going to do. If it's always a possibility, then you can't really relax because you're always having this debate with yourself. Should I be doing it now? Should I be doing it some other time? If you have designated a time, then the rest of the time you can tell yourself, oh, hey, there's a time for that. And now is not that time. So when you're thinking about your weekend, you know, think about, well, what are those projects you need to get done? And then say, well, what is the time I can do that? And, you know, as much as possible, figure out whatever support you need. If you need somebody else to take your kids during this time, if you need to trade off with your spouse, or maybe it's a time when they're all doing something else, whatever it is. But set a time, and then you can relax the rest of it.
I like that, taking the guilt out of the time when you're not getting the thing done.
Yeah, and you could do the same thing for, I mean, just housework in general. I mean, I know everyone uses the weekend to catch up on chores because, you know, if you're working all week, when else are you going to do them, right? But, again, it's housework is like email, and it can expand to fill the available space. So you need to sort of designate a time for it. And, you know, if you notice that the floor is dirty at some other point, you can be like, yeah, well, there's an hour on Sunday morning to deal with that. And it's not that hour on Sunday morning, so I'm just going to relax and live with my dirty floor.
We're talking to Laura Vanderkam, author of many time management books. Her latest is called Off the Clock, Feel Less Busy While Getting More Done. She's talking with us today about how we can get more out of our days off of work. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you end up feeling like there's not enough time when you have a day off or a weekend? Or do you struggle to decide what to do to fill your free time? Do you come out of the weekend feeling like, didn't really get what I could out of it? Or do you feel great at the end of the weekend? You've done the stuff that you wanted to do, the important stuff, the fun stuff, whatever. Tell us how you do it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation with Laura Vanderkam. She's the author of several books about time management. Her latest is called Off the Clock, Feel Less Busy While Getting More Done. We're talking about how to make your days off of work meaningful, satisfying, maybe fun, productive, whatever you want to do, and whether that includes relaxation or getting lots of stuff off of your to-do list. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your idea of a great weekend? And do you manage to make that happen? Do you get up early, have a good breakfast, take care of the things you've been putting off? Do you feel like you have too much to do on the weekend, or do you feel like you fritter away the time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hey, good afternoon and Happy New Year.
So, hey, to you too, Jeff.
Yeah, sounds good. You know, I have an excellent mattress. I love my mattress. So I know that whatever happens on any day, have a bad day, a great day, whatever, I still have my private time on my mattress because I love to sleep. I enjoy sleeping. So I set all the world aside and I just sleep. So I know I'm going to have a good day because I know I'm going to have a good sleep. From there, I do my chores like I'll multitask. So if I have to go to the laundromat, I'll put the clothes in the wash. Then I'll run an errand and I'll come back, throw them in the dryer, and I'll run another errand and come back to pick up the clothes. So I try to multitask and have a number of things going on at once.
Jeff, thanks a lot for calling in. And Laura, I think you've talked about that idea of multitasking. If you are, you know, if you're a parent and you're taxiing kids around and then waiting for things to happen, making some good use of that time.
Oh, definitely. Time in the car, I mean, can be spent listening to wonderful programs like this or podcasts or audiobooks or things like that. Certainly, if you wind up going to a lot of kids' sporting events, it really behooves you to think about, well, what could I do with this time? Because often what I see at sidelines is people just sort of thumbing around on their phones, and it's not anything they really care about. They're not really watching what's going on, but they're not doing anything else either. You know, even if you want to see your kids' time on the field or in the wrestling match or whatever it is, there's a lot of downtime too. So think about what you could do. Maybe it's read a good book. A lot of us feel like we don't have enough time to read, but that could be time that if you have an ebook with you, you've always got your phone, so pull it out and make some progress on, I don't know, reading War and Peace in the middle of that swim meet.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. We heard from Nancy in Sun Prairie. Nancy says she works a side job on weekends in addition to her 9-to-5. So planning is essential so she can relax on Sundays before she works at 4 p.m. She tries to do all of her chores in the days leading up to the weekend. So Sundays are for being at home and doing whatever she needs or wants. So that's that kind of intentional planning you were talking about earlier, Laura.
Yeah, I think that's really a great idea. I mean, she recognizes that she is working on weekends, obviously, with a side job. That's probably going to happen. But rather than spending all Saturday sort of or Sunday getting everything done and then feeling exhausted and then going to work and doing her paid job as well, she has consciously carved out that time for relaxing and figured out a way to make her chores happen during the week. And I actually think a lot of us could get more of our chores sort of done during the week or maybe lower our standards to the point where they don't really need to be done on the weekends and could carve ourselves back some open time.
Now, speaking of Sundays, let's talk about Sunday night or whatever the last day off is before we go back to work. And people might feel a little bummed out. Oh, weekend's over. I have to go back. If my boss is listening, that's not me. I love coming back to work. But not everybody does. How can we make sure that we don't have that kind of pre-work, end-of-weekend blahs on Sunday night?
Well, I think one of the best things you can do is plan something fun on Sunday night. So, you know, probably something low-key because it is a school and work night, but maybe it's a standing, you know, get-together with friends. You all have a potluck at somebody's house on Sunday evening and rotating houses, but, you know, then you've got something fun you're looking forward to all Sunday afternoon instead of already having yourself in Monday morning mindset by, you know, Sunday at 2 p.m. So I think that's a really good thing to do. But there's one other thing I would suggest doing, which is that you actually think about what you're going to do at work on Monday before you leave work on Friday. So take a little bit of time on Friday afternoon to plan your upcoming week, and particularly plan your Monday. Because often a lot of that sort of angst we're feeling on Sunday is that you know all this work is waiting for you, and you know stuff's coming up, but you don't know exactly what, and you don't know exactly how you're going to tackle it and what you're going to need to do on Monday. But if you make a plan on Friday, then you know, and then you don't have to spend your whole weekend thinking about it.
We're talking to Laura Vanderkam, time management expert and author, looking at making the most of our days off, our weekends, or whichever days you happen to have off. You can join in with your questions or your solutions at 800-642-1234. Back to our callers now. James is with us in Stevens Point. James, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What do you do to plan your days off?
Well, two of the things. One, I'd like to comment on what you said about the timetable. And you know, if you're going to start a project or you have something to do, and we're going to set a time that I'm going to start that, I'd say at like 10 o'clock. That works out well for me. That way I don't feel guilty all morning because I didn't start this project yet or whatever I'm going to do. So that helps with the mindset. And the other thing is whatever project that I may be planning, and I love that Wednesday thought that you had, I'll pick up materials for those prior to the weekend, so I'm not going into Saturday morning and I have to run to Lowe's or Ace Hardware or getting all my materials ready to go. I have everything on hand.
I love that way of thinking, James and Laura. You know, whether you're thinking about the fancy meal you're going to cook, the home renovation project you're going to do, having the ingredients in place, whether that's food or, you know, the right size bolts, whatever it might be, having things ready to rock so you don't have to take an extra half hour getting those materials when you were planning to be doing the thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's nothing worse than being like, okay, I'm ready to go. I finally have the energy to do this house project that I've been putting off for 3 months. And then you're like, and I don't have the right materials. So I guess I'll be putting it off more while I run to the hardware store and then get sidetracked with something over there. So yeah, I think that's a great suggestion. Think about the project you plan to do. Make sure you have what you need.
James, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. In one of your previous books, Laura, you talked about what successful people do on the weekends. Are there examples of people or practices that you found particularly inspiring?
Yeah, it's been a couple of years since I wrote that book. I'm trying to remember now exactly what I did. You know, one of the people I interviewed for it, of all people, is Mike Huckabee, you know, the news commentator and former governor. But he, because he was working in television, I think, at the time and had to do a weekend show, he is really focused on what he was doing on his one day off per week. And he was very focused on also making sure that he did something that was social, something that was sort of exercise-related, and something spiritual. And I think that those are great three categories for anyone thinking about the weekend. You know, am I doing something that is physical, so getting exercise or at least some sort of physical activity, you know, that would be energizing for you? Socializing tends to be energizing for people as well, so getting together with friends and family. And spiritual as well. That can be a great component of a weekend. Maybe it's going to worship services somewhere, but it could be something else, too, that you find meaningful, like volunteering. But if you put a check mark in those three categories, it would be pretty hard to say that you did not have a good weekend.
Now, how do we make sure we hold ourselves to account? We make this plan. This is a common introvert dilemma, I think. We plan to do something, maybe that social thing you mentioned. When the time comes, we think, oh, I'd rather just hang out here. But you know that if you went out and did the thing, in hindsight, you really would enjoy it. How do we make sure we stick to that plan?
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between scheduling stuff in that you actually don't really want to do, but you're kind of hoping that you'll have a different personality by the weekend. I mean, that's just not going to happen. You are who you are. And so, you know, particularly if you're planning stuff far in the future, it always helps to ask yourself if you would do the thing tomorrow. Because if you wouldn't do it tomorrow, like, then you probably aren't going to want to do it in 2 months either. So don't put it on your schedule for the weekend in the future either. But if it's something you know you will like you've liked it in the past, and you know, it's just getting over that initial hurdle. I think I like to repeat this mantra to myself, which is plan it in, do it anyway. Because if we're looking for a perfect time where we're never going to be tired or never going to have something else that we have to do, right, that time does not exist. we'll always be tired. Like, we'll always, you know, find it difficult to, like, get up and get our shoes on and get in the car and go somewhere. You know, it's always easier to stay put. But if you just stay put watching TV, like, you know, life becomes this sort of unmemorable, undistinguishable mass of time. And, you know, when we have no memories, we feel like time is just passing us by. So, you know, if you've planned something in and you know you will be happy about it afterwards, just tell yourself, do it anyway, because I promise you that once you get going, you'll find it very energizing. We draw energy from meaningful things.
That reminds me, there's one thing you wrote about that I wanted to get into before we run out of time. You've suggested we create a bucket list for our weekends, maybe including things like, you know, in that 1 or 2 hour radius from where we live that we can plan to do, or when we've got time, we can spontaneously do. What kind of things are on your list right now?
Well, I have 4 small children, and it is January when we were talking. So, you know, there's a lot of indoor stuff. And I don't know if I would refer to it, what I've made, as so much as a bucket list, as like a survival list, things that I could do with my 4 small children to keep us all from going crazy in the house. So, you know, a lot of like indoor museums or play places or, you know, tolerable outdoor activities that you could do in winter. But, you know, this is a good list for people to make in general because, you know, we often tell ourselves we have no time. And then when time appears, we don't know what we want to do with it. And so we spend it in the sort of lowest transaction cost possible, which is surfing the web, watching TV, puttering around the house. And again, those things aren't very memorable. So, you know, if you've got a few minutes now or maybe tonight or sometime tomorrow, sit down and make a list of anything that might be fun, meaningful for some combination of family members that's within an hour or two of your house. So maybe it's that state park you keep saying you want to visit, or the lake you want to go to, or an ice skating rink that's in town, or, you know, a basketball game, or just anything you might want to do. And that way, when you're thinking about your weekend, you say, oh, what should we do this weekend? Well, you've got a list. And you can pull something from that list and see what other people want to do from that list. And it helps just, you know, have some ideas so you don't have to spend all that time and energy thinking about it in the moment.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us and sharing this great advice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Laura Vanderkam is the author of several time management and productivity books, including What the Most Successful People Do on the Weekends and Off the Clock, Feel Less Busy While Getting More Done. She joins today to talk about how to make the most of your weekend. Hey, do you have something like that on your list, those things you want to do in your part of the state and are just waiting for that opportunity on a weekend to do them? Send us your list or your ideas. Email ideas@WPR.org, and I'll steal them from you. Coming up after the news, we'll learn about new research finding that small creeks and streams could have a big impact on Lake Superior. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new proposal in the state legislature would criminalize first offense drunk driving, toughen the penalties on repeat offenders, and more. We'll talk with the author of that bill coming up. First, the Great Lakes are big, so it's easy to think that one tiny stream or creek doesn't have much of an impact once it reaches the shore. But new research finds that the combined effect of those streams might be bigger than we thought. Scientists at Michigan Tech looked into the plumes of sediment flowing into Lake Superior from thousands of small tributaries, especially after big rainstorms. Their research included aerial drones, an underwater vehicle, and good old-fashioned boats. Amy Marcarelli is an associate professor of biological sciences at Michigan Technological University. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, now, the Great Lakes are unique in a lot of ways, and one thing that makes them unique is when you look at those watershed maps, you look at the Mississippi River, it's got a huge watershed. The Great Lakes, it looks really small on the map. A lot of the water, I guess, comes from rain, so it's been easy to overlook the impact of those tributaries in the past, right?
Yeah, and that's exactly what got us interested in this research in the first place. So when I came to the Great Lakes about 10 years ago, I had been studying how streams and lakes interact in watersheds that are more like the Mississippi, where there's really big watersheds and really small lakes. And as I started to ask people, you know, how important are the streams? The answer was, well, we don't really know, but we think not very important because the watershed is so small.
So what difference, well, actually, first, how many of these little tributaries are there going into Lake Superior?
That's a really good question. And the answer is that it's not easy to figure that out. So for our paper, we put together the most recent hydrology data that was available from the U.S. and from Canada and came up with about 2,800 streams coming into Lake Superior. About 10 of them, the biggest, make up about half of the watershed. But there are hundreds of small streams that make up the other half of that watershed.
I've spent a lot of time where those streams come into Lake Superior, not far from where you work in Houghton there. And depending on the time of the year, it's this little trickle that might not even make it through the beach. And then in the spring, yep, it can really be a lot of water coming through. It varies a lot depending on the season, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we think of all of the rivers are most important when the snow is melting up here, which, you know, when that happens varies year to year. But how much comes out at other times of the year really depends on how much rain has fallen in the immediate area prior. So some of these really small streams might go completely dry in the summer, whereas others may feed in all year long and put in these pulses of material at different times. And the size and the timing of when the material comes out of those streams and the water is going to really vary depending on whether you're talking about a big watershed or a small watershed.
So what do those streams do? What kind of impact do they have on Lake Superior, the streams and the sediment they carry?
Yeah, so one of the really important things that they do is they put in nutrients. And, you know, Lake Superior we value among the Great Lakes because it has this really clean, clear water. And that's in part because there's not a lot of algal production. And the streams deliver the nutrients that are really key for the productivity of the algae and the microbes in the near shore of Lake Superior. We often think about tributaries being important when they are delivering too many nutrients and causing problems with cyanobacteria and algal blooms, like in Lake Erie or maybe in Green Bay. But in places where there's not a lot of nutrients, that can mean that there's not a lot of algae growing, and so not a lot of food to feed the zooplankton that feed the small fish that feed the big fish. So one of the things that we're really interested in thinking about is how these tributaries may deliver nutrients, particularly phosphorus, which is the most common limiting nutrient, and how that may fuel this near-shore productivity that may be really important for sustaining the Lake Superior food web.
Talking to Amy Marcarelli from Michigan Tech, looking at tributaries of Lake Superior, the small streams, creeks, and rivers that feed into Lake Superior and the impact they have on the lake. So, Amy, follow along with us on, I guess, the plume where one of these streams goes into Lake Superior. What kind of things are you looking at there?
So what we're really interested in is, first off, do these plumes where the streams come in have distinct water chemistry? And a lot of our study in the recently published paper was actually just going out and driving our boats through the plumes, collecting water samples and trying to see what was different. And one of the interesting things that we found out is that you may know from being on these streams around our area that many are stained. They have this darker water color. That's due to the dissolved organic carbon that's in the water. That's natural material, but it makes this sort of dark color that we can actually detect both if we take samples back to the lab and analyze them, but also with sensors in the field. And so we're getting really interested in, can we use sensors to measure how big the plumes are? And what that will allow us to do is to estimate when we do have these big plumes coming out, say, during snowmelt or during summer rainstorms when maybe we can't get on the lake to grab a sample with our boat or to understand how big the plumes are. Can we use those sensors to estimate how much water and how much material is coming out of the streams under this full suite of conditions?
Now, I think of a stream ending, right, when it pours into the lake, but it sounds like it's really still going on, maybe pretty far out.
Yeah, and the interesting part is that there were times that we've been out trying to sample when maybe the stream kind of does end right at the mouth. There, if you go out, it may have just a very small area, but there are other times when there's a lot of water coming out that it may make really big plumes. We went out and tried to do some sampling of a river plume this past summer with sensors mounted on an underwater autonomous vehicle that we have here at Michigan Tech, and we set up a plan to run it sort of in and out of the plume, and happened to be out sampling the day after a pretty big rainstorm in July, and discovered that the plume was actually filling the whole bay that we were trying to sample.
Wow.
All the way out and mixing quite far out, which we discovered because we also had a drone that we were flying overhead to look for the different watercolors, and discovered the line where the dark water was mixing in with the light blue Lake Superior water many kilometers offshore from where we were sampling. So sometimes they can be really, really big and you may not even realize it.
Now, you got hit with a pretty big flood this last summer, as did a lot of northern Wisconsin. What kind of difference does an event make like that in Lake Superior itself?
Yeah, you know, the big floods that happened this year were and actually have happened prior years in northern Wisconsin as well have been interesting, because not only are they moving this water and the dissolved material, but they're also eroding a lot of sediment. And they make these really big sediment plumes, which actually were visible using satellite imagery for a long time this summer. And a lot of those images were shared via social media and in the news. And that sediment will have phosphorus bound to it as well. And that will then be transported into the lake and released later and may, again, fuel algal productivity. So one of the interesting things that we saw this summer were cyanobacteria blooms along near shore in Ashland and Bayfield. And researchers in Wisconsin and in Minnesota were studying those plumes and think that the fact that those happened this summer were associated with the sediment that was delivered during those rainstorms in late June and early July. So we may see sort of delayed effects of those runoff events in the nearshore productivity.
It seems like these tributaries of Lake Superior have been understudied in some ways. And I think you've said that this research is as much about raising questions as it is providing answers. So what kind of questions now are you hoping to look at in the years to come?
Yeah, so I think one question that we have is we've been looking at plumes and just the streams around us here in Houghton. A question that we have is, do other tributaries behave the same way as the streams that we've been looking at here? Can we use these autonomous technologies to really understand how the nutrient delivery may change with storms of different sizes or at different times of years in different parts of the lake, how they actually mix into the lake by doing some whole lake modeling, and then how might they change in the future with climate change if we're seeing more frequent or more severe summer storms or changing in the accumulation or timing of snowmelt, how that may lead to changes in these stream lake linkages.
And I've been in Lake Superior in August, and it's ranged from brutally cold to, you know, not quite so brutally cold. Does the temperature when that sediment is coming in make a difference in things like the algae blooms and cyanobacteria?
Absolutely. Well, the temperature of the lake when relative to the streams will affect first just how the water mixes together. Waters of different temperature may or may not mix depending on the wind or the current. So you may see differences in where the water actually goes. And then if those nutrients are going into warm lake water, the algae and other microbes certainly grow faster when the water is warm. So the timing of that material relative to the temperature that the organisms are experiencing in the lake will make a big difference on what effect it has.
Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, I was really glad to be here to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
That's Amy Marcarelli, Associate Professor of Biological Sciences at Michigan Tech. She was with us to talk about her and her colleagues' research showing that the impact of small tributaries, the streams, creeks, and rivers on Lake Superior, that impact could be a lot bigger than previously thought. Coming up, the push to crack down on drunken driving here in Wisconsin continues, with a new governor supporting some changes to state law. We'll talk about, among other things, a proposal that first-time offenders would be liable for criminal charges. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump was heavily criticized by some for his decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria, but our guest says Trump is doing the right thing. First, two Republican state lawmakers are renewing their push to crack down on drunken driving. Right now, Wisconsin is one of the only states where first offense drunk driving is a civil violation, not a crime. Under this proposal, that would become a misdemeanor punishable by a fine and jail time. Other bills in a new package target repeat offenders as well as those convicted of homicide by intoxicated use of a vehicle. Representative Jim Ott and Senator Alberta Darling have been working for nearly a decade on increasing the penalties for drunken driving. Many of their proposals haven't come to a vote. However, they've got potentially a new ally in Governor Tony Evers, who says he supports the move to criminalize first offenders. Jim Ott is a Republican state representative from Mequon and co-author of a number of bills to create stiffer penalties for drunk driving. Representative Ott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Rob. Good to be with you.
Before we get into the specific proposals, can you talk about why this has been such a focus for you over your legislative career?
Well, Rob, I'll tell you, over the years, we hear of so many, on a semi-regular basis, absolutely tragic situations where a drunk driver crosses the center line and wipes out a person or wipes out their family or puts someone in a wheelchair or hits a bicyclist and then drives away and leaves them dying on the side of the road. I mean, this goes on and on. And, people will say, well, over the last 20 or 30 years, the incidence of drunk driving in Wisconsin has decreased. It hasn't decreased enough because you can be driving home from work at night, you can be on the way to a friend's house, and encounter somebody who should not be behind the wheel, and your life is in peril. So I've gotten to know and meet many of the families who've lost loved ones, and it's just an ongoing tragedy for them, and it's something no one should have to put up with.
Well, let's talk about this idea of criminalizing first-time offenses. This is something that the overwhelming majority of states have done. Why do you think it's been a challenge to get this done here in Wisconsin?
Well, and speaking of the overwhelming majority of states, we are actually the only state that first offense is not a criminal penalty misdemeanor. And so we're the last one that hasn't gone that route. One of the pushbacks that we sometimes get when we talk about criminalizing first offense is, well, what about a college kid who goes out, you know, and parties a little bit too hard, he gets one OWI, never does anything wrong the rest of his life, including drunk driving, and now he's saddled, or she is saddled with a criminal misdemeanor for the rest of their life. And there certainly is evidence that there are people who get the message after a first offense, because if you look at the Department of Transportation statistics, we have more first offenders in Wisconsin than second offenders. There's more second offenders than third offenders. So for a lot of people that do get an OWI, the message does get through. And what we're doing with this bill to address that issue is that first offense would become a criminal misdemeanor, a Class C misdemeanor, which is a low-level misdemeanor, but it nevertheless is a crime punishable by up to $500 fine, up to 30 days in jail. But if the person does not get another OWI for a five-year period, that criminal misdemeanor would revert to a civil forfeiture, just like it is right now. So that would, in a situation where somebody really does clean up their act and say, I'm never going to do this again, they would have the opportunity to have this criminal misdemeanor removed from their record. On the other hand, someone who had a first offense and then they had a second offense within 5 years, that first offense would remain a criminal misdemeanor. And, of course, the second offense would be a criminal misdemeanor, just like if it happened 6 years after the first offense, the second offense would still be a criminal misdemeanor. So hopefully that addresses that concern.
Another objection that people have raised is the cost of enforcement, saying, it's going to cost a lot in police time, legal expenses, that sort of thing. What do you say to that worry?
Well, the biggest issue with the cost has been from the Department of Corrections, who, and this was in particular to two of the bills that I've reintroduced this time, the one that would require 18 months in prison for fifth and sixth offenders and 5 years in prison for someone convicted of homicide OWI. Right now, there's no mandatory minimum for homicide OWI, and you do hear, not too many, but you hear often enough where somebody kills somebody while they were drunk, and they get like a year in jail. I mean, which is a double insult to the family. In addition to losing someone, you know, it looks like the legal system is not taking their loss even seriously. So last session, we did actually get those two bills passed out of committee in the assembly, but they kind of were derailed by the large fiscal note from Department of Corrections. And I have kind of an ongoing issue with their fiscal notes because I'm not introducing these bills to put more people in prison and increase cost. I'm introducing the bills and hopefully getting them into law to act as a deterrent so that when somebody gets their fourth offense in Wisconsin, that the judge and their attorney says to them, do this again, you're going to prison for 18 months, as compared to right now, which may be 6 months and maybe even probation. I think that would be a strong message, and hopefully, at least in some cases, would provide the needed deterrent to get someone to not get their fifth or their sixth offense.
Talking to Jim Ott, Republican state representative from Mequon, co-author of a number of bills aimed at sifting penalties for drunken driving in Wisconsin. Representative Ott, let's talk about that deterrence idea. I've heard people say, you pass laws like these, you send a social message, a cultural message to people that hopefully just changes the way we think about drunken driving. Is that part of what you're hoping to accomplish?
Well, absolutely. And you know, Rob, I've been working on this for years now, and we have had some important bills passed. We did get the ignition interlock loophole closed last session, and two sessions ago we did get fourth offense to be a felony no matter when it happens. You know, I think, come on, fourth offense, that's somebody who's chronically driving drunk. So, part of it is keeping the discussion in the forefront and maybe getting some people who might get behind the wheel drunk to maybe think about it before they actually do it. And we have all kinds of alternatives to driving drunk today. A lot of bars have safe ride programs. You can get a designated driver. Obviously, we have more opportunities for public transportation today, like Uber and Lyft, that's available even in rural areas. So there are alternatives. So part of it is just, you know, making the impression of, first of all, what a devastating effect drunk driving has had on so many families in Wisconsin and some individuals who are actually in wheelchairs because of being hit by a drunk driver, and getting that out there so that people can make a wiser decision to not get behind the wheel when they're impaired. And again, you know, there's no reason that you have to. So, hopefully, the part of bringing these bills up is to keep the message going, but I want to get the bills passed.
How about treatment? Because you see things in the papers all the time in Wisconsin, somebody arrested for their 7th or 11th or 13th, whatever, drunk driving offense. It doesn't seem like any message is getting through there. Are there treatment options? Have you supported those or passed those already, or are you working on those?
I certainly have supported those, and we do have some treatment courts in Wisconsin. I don't think every county has them, but some counties do, where they do give, you know, alternatives to incarceration. And generally, it's one opportunity. You can't continually keep saying, well, I drove drunk again, I'm going to go back to treatment. You know, at some point, you do have to face what you did. But there are options available for treatment. And actually, I think most cases, a person does have an opportunity at least once to do some treatment in place of simply incarceration. And I certainly support that. But again, when you hear somebody who's getting a third and a fourth and a fifth, this is someone who is habitually getting behind the wheel drunk, because people aren't caught every time they drive drunk. And the statistics, in terms of some of the studies that have been done, have shown that by the time a person gets caught the first time, they may have been driving intoxicated as much as 70 or 80 times. Also, about half of all crashes in Wisconsin, alcohol-related crashes, involve someone with no prior conviction, which tells me that many times a person gets caught the first time because they crash into something like a tree or somebody else's car.
Now, Governor Evers was inaugurated yesterday. He has spoken in support of at least the criminalizing that first offense. Do you see this as opportunity? There's going to be differences, but do you see this as an opportunity for you and some of your Republican colleagues to work with a Democratic governor and get some of these bills over the hump?
I think so. Certainly the fact that he said he's open to the idea is better than if he would have said he's closed to the idea. But, you know, I think any bill, and we got bills to Governor Walker's desk and he signed them. So I think if you can get the bill to the governor's desk and it's a sensible bill, certainly it should be signed. But I'm glad that he said he's open to the idea of looking at first offense OWI as a criminal misdemeanor, because, you know, obviously if he didn't, that would be another hurdle to cross.
And briefly, just 20 seconds or so, do you think Republican leadership in your own party is going to be on board this time around?
They have been in the past. And again, part of the hurdle to get across here is these fiscal notes. And I've been trying to work with Department of Corrections to, you know, maybe get them to look at the fact that we are talking deterrence here, and we're not really trying to incarcerate more people. We want there to be less drunk driving. If there's less drunk driving, there will be less people incarcerated, and our roads will be safer. And that's the ultimate goal of all of this.
It's a good place to leave it. Representative Ott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Rob. Thank you.
That's Jim Ott, Republican State Representative from Mequon. He joined us to talk about a package of drunken driving-related legislation that he and some of his colleagues are working on in this legislative session. Here's the deal. You want pizza. You want more pizza. Are you better off getting two 12-inch pizzas or one 18-inch? Which one has more pizza? Gut reaction, 12-inch pizza plus 12-inch pizza equals a 24-inch pizza, right? That's more than 18. Wrong. The Twitter feed Fermat's Library tackled this question. They post fun math and science facts. They did some quick maths. The area of a circle is pi r squared, or pizza pi r squared, if you will. Run the numbers. The 18-inch pizza has 254 square inches. Those 12-inch guys, two of them, still only 226 square inches. So there's 28 more square inches of pizza in the single 18-inch option. Okay, now I wanted to take it a step further to add value for you. So I went out to compare prices. First, I had a hard time finding places that sold a 12 and an 18-inch pizza. There's one that had 18, but they skipped the 12. Lot didn't have pizza bigger than 16 inches on the menu. I finally found one, though. Here was the price. 12-inch cheese pizza, $9.50. 18-inch cheese pizza, $16.75. I open up my calculator app. 12-inch, just over 8.4 cents per square inch. For those two 12-inch pizzas now. 18-inch pizza, just 7.3 cents per square inch. You save a penny per square inch with the 18-inch over two 12s. Helping your pizza dollar go a bit further, this is Central Time.